Hey, greetings from the studio, and it's almost Christmas, so Merry Christmas to all you folks out there. I hate the word folks. Anyway, we are live in the studio getting ready to play this week's Bob Davis Podcasts radio show, so let's just go ahead and roll segment one of Bob Davis Podcasts radio show 58. Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. For all the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit the BobDavisPodcasts.com. Welcome back. So in this show, so it's official. Donald Trump has won the Electoral College vote, and it's time to shift the conversation away from the constant talk about injustices, real or perceived, of the American system, away from reliance on the storylines that are generated by politicians and the media and the public relations people, toward the challenges ahead. Is there a new politics in America? Is this new administration really going to implement so-called conservative economic principles? And by the way, what are conservative economic principles? And how do we meet probably the biggest challenge of the next 2 years, which is getting the economy in this country to grow? So to start, as you know, if you've been listening to the podcast and this show, I covered the 2016 primary races up close and personal, and I covered the Republican convention at Cleveland. To do that, I traveled not just across Iowa and South Carolina in Mobile Podcast Command, but I crisscrossed the whole country more than once on back roads, medium and small towns, farmland, big cities, and so forth. And as I reported then in the podcast, I felt the final outcome of the election in this year would center on what some have derisively called the Rust Belt, the Great Lakes region. And this suggests that there are no people left in northern Minnesota's Iron Range or North Michigan's ports or mining areas or industrial areas in Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And yes, there is a palpable difference between the western seaboard, Seattle to San Francisco to LA, versus Duluth and Youngstown and the American Upper Midwest to the Great Lakes region, but there are still a lot of people in this part of the world. These parts of the country are plagued by bad economic and domestic policy initiatives, corruption, and ineffective, if not incompetent, local and state governance. And if you've been paying attention these last few years, you're seeing these issues play out in these places. It's not a surprise that they would have had a potential impact in this presidential election. And it just so happens that an overconfident Democratic candidate lost the war on this battlefield. Democrats made their last stand this week with a scrim of protesters at a few beleaguered state capitals, while electors did their duty generally and cast their votes according to state law and party lines. Despite predictions that as many as 20 electors are going to, you know, we're going to abandon Trump, it turns out that the only contestant in this election year that they abandoned was, in fact, the former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. And while the Clintons and their supporters stamp their feet and scream injustice and argue that the Electoral College isn't democratic, that some dark conspiracy has put Trump in the White House, you know, I can't help but ask the question, if Democrats were so concerned about such an outcome, why didn't they show up at the polls on Election Day in those states that mattered? And part of it is, I think they were told that she was going to win, as I have talked about. But also, I think people there were used to huge advantages in New York and California and Democrat strongholds like Detroit and Chicago and Cleveland, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and so forth. They were supremely confident that they would win in these places because that's the way it's always been, which is the kiss of death for almost anyone in any pursuit. If you do things today the way things have always been, you're going to eventually find yourself out of luck. Now, the new storyline is that Trump's now sealed victory suddenly means there will be a new kind of politics in America. Either it's going to be a harder, darker politics, it's going to be a throwback to the 1950s. It's going to be a white-only, jingoistic, or xenophobic leadership that encourages our worst instincts, or it's a new kind of politics called populism, or conservative politics, populism, or inexplicably, it's Trump's victory indicating that there is a new sort of centrism in American politics. It isn't partisan. It isn't tied to a specific party identification. It's all about solving problems. None of this is true. I don't know how many times I have to say this, but first of all, it is going to be some time before we will understand what actually happened in this election. There's always a first blush of analysis, and that's fine. It's usually based on election day polling. That's already been debunked. The second blush of analysis based on vote totals by county is usually debunked by the third and fourth level of analysis, which is based on precincts, vote totals, comparing previous elections and census data, employing some form of sophisticated statistical analysis that really kind of gives us a better picture. Then we have these labels that accompany and buttress these narratives that we see in the media or storylines. Trump's an authoritarian. Trump's a conservative. Trump's a populist. Fill in the blank. Conservative populism is this. Centrism is that. Look at how people in the suburbs voted versus the rural area. You know, the suburban people are centrists or independents, and on it goes. And I would suggest that basically, if you really want to understand what's going on, just ignore it all, because there is no populist political movement in the United States. What is populism? The word itself is derived from the Latin word populist or people, which to me is so nonspecific that it could describe anyone in politics. In America, the word populist is to suggest a member of a political party claiming to represent the common people, which again is pretty wide in terms of its focus. Or you could actually refer to the populist political movement, which and the party, which existed in the late 1890s in this country, to represent agricultural interests generally in a relatively new and sparsely populated states in the Midwest and West. And it also, the populist political party, advocated the free coinage of silver and gold and government control of monopolies. Every political candidate since Abraham Lincoln in this country has wanted to be thought of as some kind of rail splitter who emerged fully formed from a forest, you know, in a log cabin, somewhere in the middle of the country. But the truth is that politicians for a long period of time have not been born in log cabins. Hillary Clinton was born into an upper middle class family in suburban Chicago. She went to Wellesley and Yale. Donald Trump grew up in what was then and still is a part of the city of New York, but was really a suburban middle class neighborhood. He went to Fordham and Wharton. Hardly populist beginnings for either candidate. The facts are most of the Republicans in office as governors, state legislators in the states, state senators, and in U.S., in the U.S. Congress are moderate Republicans. They are not populist. Using populist political tactics and fighting for the people and so on could apply to Paul Wellstone, or it could apply to Mitch McConnell, right? It doesn't make a politician a populist. Most of the Democrats in office represent urban and wealthy suburban communities and would be considered moderates in their own party. Most of the people Donald Trump has selected to be part of his administration are either business people, not known for their extreme political or populist views, or members of the current Republican moderate leadership, including the vice president. So for both sides, whatever the rhetoric and storylines, whatever the expectations or the fears about a future Trump presidency, while the tone of government and the approach of government will certainly change to a degree, the qualities and philosophy and approach of the power elite in Washington has not and probably will not. Which brings me to the next point and what I'm going to focus on in this show, and that is the challenges that we face as a nation, how we're going to meet them, and how the challenges are actually going to be met by a group of centrist, moderate politicians, really in both parties, who remain out of touch with what this country really needs and what the people really need, which is really this question of how much government we have, how it is structured, what it actually does, and what its effects are, and you know, the level of legal or illegal corruption that exists in states that you might be surprised about. So there's a lot of stuff about the actual, you know, makeup and constitution of our government. I don't mean the U.S. Constitution, that is going to come into play in terms of addressing the kinds of problems, economic and otherwise, that we have in this country going forward. So the new storyline is that there is a new base of Republican voters driving the bus. Well, I'm not so sure. The new storyline is that there's a new base of populist voters that are driving the bus. And the question is, will Donald Trump and the Republicans throw them off at the first stop? Coming up, this is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. pom poom to doom pom. I would say it's hard to believe that we are approaching a new year. It's hard to believe it's 2017, but it's not hard to believe because it's, of course, at the end of the month of December, and January's coming up. So to be quite literal, you know, the idea that it's a surprise that it's a new year is kind of funny. But New Year's means, let me take a sip of coffee. New Year's means that companies, large and small, are going to start thinking about team building exercises. And if you haven't heard about Brush Studio in the West End, let me explain what a great option it is for team building exercises. Because you either take people to a hotel conference room or you do some weird physical thing like rappelling off a cliff or whatever. But if you are the person who suggests new team building exercises, or you're the person that has to plan these things, or the person that has to make the decision to do it, let me tell you about how to book a great new, sophisticated, and fun way to bond with employees and clients at Brush Studio in the West End, St. Louis Park. Brush Studio events are held in a relaxed and social setting. It's like a party. And what happens is an artist guides your people through a featured painting step by step. Now, here's the thing. This is a great opportunity for everybody on the team to bond without having to walk across coals, of course, like you often have to do with these crazy things. Brush Studio events are designed for left-brain people to bring out the right brain, and that means ideas. So you get bonding, and you get people thinking creatively, and that is so much better than spending all day in a hotel conference room with cold sandwiches. At Brush Studio in the West End, they have room for 55 people. They have catering from Crave in the West End. They have 22 brands of beer and an extensive wine collection. If you go to brushstudio.net or click on the banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page, you will see pictures and video of what it's like, and people really have a good time. And the only other thing I will say is, given today's diverse workforce, the ideas for team building that worked 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago aren't going to work anymore. Your people will appreciate this event. Check them out, brushstudio.net. Let me grab the number real quick so we can get you hooked up. Brushstudio.net or 952-236-1700, 952-236-1700, or you can click on that banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page, brushstudio.net. Thanks, guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. Yes, I just woke up, so getting all the copy points in right after I wake up is quite a challenge. All right, some more coffee, and we will roll segment two of this week's Bob Davis podcast radio show. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. To hear more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Again, it's going to be some time before we fully understand what happened in the 2016 election. The latest batch of data says suburban voters were soft for Trump. His votes came from rural areas and small towns. Enough votes to overwhelm Clinton in key electoral states and provoking all this talk about populism. Despite all the talk about electoral mutinies, electors did their job this week according to state law. A handful of electors in Democrat states voted for Republican alternatives to Trump, further shaving Hillary Clinton's electoral votes and strengthening Trump's electoral victory, although there were two Republicans who were recalcitrant or unfaithful electors. The Electoral College vote isn't tradition. It is part of the United States Constitution, governed by state election law and state political party rules. And as I told you on last week's show, despite all the talk about abolishing the electoral system, it protects states with smaller populations from being dominated by states with larger populations. In the true sense of the Republican tradition, the Electoral College protects the minority against the whim of the majority. I also explained last week that getting rid of the Electoral College might take two constitutional amendments and changes in state election laws, and it would have to be ratified by two-thirds of the state legislature. So all the anger and frustration focused on the Electoral College really is just puffery. We're going to be back into another presidential cycle before anybody is going to have a chance to mount a successful amendment fight. And by then, a Democrat candidate might benefit from an electoral victory, and suddenly it'll be the Republicans complaining about the Electoral College. More important is the deification of President-elect Trump as a savior and change agent, the irrational fears about what a Trump presidency means. Remember, there are still Democrat congressmen and senators. There are still Democrat governors and state legislators, Democrat city and town mayors and councils, Democrat county councils, Democrat states, Democrats on planning and education boards in local communities. Most of the time, the majority party and the party in control of the White House actually loses races in the congressional cycle. So if you're a Democrat, you are in the minority currently, but there's always another election coming up. As far as Trump supporters are concerned, and those who think the 2016 election heralds a, quote, new kind of politics, the Republican leadership in Congress and Trump's advisors and cabinet nominees are generally moderate Republicans. Going back to the convention, the Republican leadership made a Faustian bargain with the Trump team to make sure the convention couldn't do its job, which is to deliberate and vote on a candidate for president. This is exactly what moderates, in firm control, by the way, of the Republican Party, are going to continue to do with a Trump presidency. The good news for people who are worried is he is going to have to work through his cabinet and the Republican leadership in Congress, the moderate Republican leadership in Congress. For now, supporters are pressuring some GOP legislators who've expressed doubt about Trump's ideas. But when he gets in office and starts spending political capital and people start voting, in other words, members start voting on things, that's going to change. My experience with Trump supporters is their mantra is pretty much, I'm fed up and I'm not going to take it anymore. I want things changed and I want things changed now. I don't care how. Trump will change it because he will be the president. Well, you know, talk radio program directors tell us radio hosts not to even say the word policy because it's a tune out. People don't want to talk about policy. You know, you're not supposed to say the word even. Well, what is policy? It's the sum of the work of the three branches of government. It's the sum of the total of laws passed by the current legislatures and governors and presidents and court decisions that support or strike down those laws, and the sum of initiatives by presidents in those areas they can control directly, as well as previous presidents and previous Congresses. And policy has consequences. In the last 8 years, we are seeing the policy consequences in economic and domestic policy. The stimulus that was supposed to fix the economy, banking legislation that was supposed to make bankers and Wall Street honest, Obamacare that was supposed to give Americans affordable medical insurance coverage, a change in the U.S. approach to foreign policy that was supposed to usher in an era of peace and international cooperation, among other things. Well, the test of policy is whether or not it worked. We have had 1% economic growth pretty much since 2008, despite borrowing trillions of dollars, block granting most of it to the states, so much that even the United States government couldn't spend it all. We have most bankers and Wall Street experts telling us that Dodd-Frank and other legislation directed at banking did not fix the problems they feel created the 2008 financial crisis. We have a U.S. foreign policy that really hasn't resulted in any real gains or changes, and what many experts would describe as major setbacks for the West and the United States, in particular over the last 8 years. Certainly some of that's been caused by Bush missteps, but most of what we're doing now is Obama's foreign policy. And while he deserves credit, he also deserves the blame where it applies. And then there's Obamacare, which has become an unwieldy entitlement, placing tremendous burdens financially on the people it was designed to help, and making health insurance more expensive generally than it was before, with less coverage and actually benefiting insurance companies. Now, this is all water over the dam at this point. The point of this discussion is whatever Trump wants to do has to be processed through legislatures and courts. He will be able to rescind or issue new executive orders in some cases, which may make some changes. There will be different leadership at the top in many departments. But most importantly, there will be consequences, good and bad, to the policy he is able to enact. So the question becomes, What are his economic ideas and the ideas of this new administration and the Republican majority in the House and Senate? What are the foreign policy ideas of these same forces? What might the consequences of those ideas be specifically, not just for all of us, but for the people who voted for Donald J. Trump to be president of the United States and for Republicans in general? The economic problems of the country are a lot bigger than using trade protectionist policy to, quote, bring back jobs to the United States. When Amazon just opened a store that has no checkouts, when McDonald's is installing order kiosks that do not require cashiers, there are going to be reactions to what this administration does, even when those ideas become policy. Now, there's a good chance that many of Trump's supporters that didn't want to know details will therefore not understand the results of these policy initiatives and won't be able to support them, and essentially will be thrown under the proverbial political bus. We'll see. But, you know, again, the challenges are what policy are they going to come up with? What's actually going to pass? And what are the effects going to be? And so we have to pay really close attention to the philosophy of the people that are now in charge of this government, as well as the minority party, which is the Democratic Party. So the next couple of years are going to be really instructive in terms of where we are headed next. So coming up, yeah, I think the number one issue we face is economic, first of all, and I'm going to talk about the technology revolution, and I'm going to talk about what's happening in this country that goes beyond government, but I think the number one issue is economic. Let's get the lay of the land first, and then we're going to talk about whether our problems can be solved in the next 2 years. Next. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. For all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. Yeah, I've got this giant Arizona cup that is like a whole pot of coffee, and this is the whole thing. And every time I look at it, it's huge. It's like having a pot of coffee to drink. And I think of all the travels that I have been on this year, you know, all across the country in Mobile Podcast Command, which is a Ford 450 Super Duty diesel ambulance. I love this thing. And it came from xgovernmentcars.com. Now, xgovernmentcars.com is Minnesota's only dealer specializing in one-owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks, and SUVs. And the focus towards the end of the year is, of course, SUVs. If you have a job, if you need a car, and you need a loan, you can get approved for credit at xgovernmentcars.com. And of course, they take trades, and they pay the highest values every day for trades. But here's the focus. They've got some awesome SUVs. And wintertime in the upper Midwest means the need for SUVs. Ed has Expeditions. He has Yukons. And of course, they still have the Dodge Chargers and the Ford Police sedans and the Ford Police SUVs. But you still got some time toward the end of the year as of the recording of this podcast, which is just toward the last week of December. They're giving you $500 off any SUV now through the end of the year at xgovernmentcars.com. And of course, they have the 3-day love it guarantee exclusively at xgovernmentcars. And these Expeditions came from Border Patrol and the FBI. The FBI ones are super clean. So get your butt down to xgovernmentcars. They're now open in Golden Valley, 2420 Nevada Avenue North. You can call them at 763-777-8782 or go online and check out the selection at
xgovernmentcars.com.
Okay, here's segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Here we go. You're hearing the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. To hear more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. We're back. So what are the economic challenges in the next 4 years for the United States? And can a Republican president working with a Republican majority meet these challenges? Well, let's start with the current situation. Despite all the talk about U.S. economic growth in the last quarter of 2016, despite all of the discussions about the economy that Obama has bequeathed the new president, the fact is that the United States economy has generally grown between 1 and 1.5% since the banking crisis in 2008. Compare that to the average 3% economic growth prior to that. So with a $16 trillion economy in general, if we had faster economic growth over the last 8 years, we could have a 20-plus trillion-dollar economy, which would have made a huge difference in our standard of living and productivity. Labor force participation in the United States is at the lowest level in 40 years. Almost all the jobs created in the last few years have been part-time or contract positions. Yes, despite all the rhetoric about good jobs for working families, and all the things the state governments and the federal government have done for industry, the policies that these entities have created have not resulted in producing the, quote, good jobs politicians like to talk about. Why? Well, it's because the government doesn't produce jobs. The economy produces jobs, not the government. The U.S. economy is just not growing fast enough to produce good jobs, and that's the bottom line. Even with the so-called growth that we have, which is 1% in general, technology, comparative advantage, and regulation continues to eliminate jobs or force them into low-cost labor producers overseas, or actually lower-cost labor producers in the United States in the southern tier. This has been the hardest on the middle part of the country in the north, the so-called industrial heartland of America, and it's been best for the technology and software producers on the West Coast and East Coast and the big cities. This is probably a better and further explanation of what happened in the 2016 electoral vote than almost any other explanation. Almost 63% of America's eligible workers are sidelined for one reason or another. Social Security benefits paid to people younger than retirement age are skyrocketing. Early retirement, for whatever reason, is skyrocketing. Socially, this is being translated into arguments about minimum wage and minimum income and legislation to address those activities, the political activities in cities and states, and in some cases in Congress. Those who voted for Donald Trump because they believed he's going to force China and Mexico to box up those jobs that we sent them a while back and send them back, and that the job at the local plant with its salary and benefits are going to come back, that's what people who voted for Donald Trump, I think. And I suppose that anything is possible. Hope springs eternal. But consider the fact that 88% of the jobs lost in the last few years have been due to IT and local causes, not comparative advantage or international competition. Closing plants in Flint, Michigan, and building them in Tennessee and North Carolina and Georgia and Kentucky, as well as IT in those industries, have produced, they produce more with fewer, people. Closing plants and moving production to low-cost labor competitors in North America, Eastern Europe, and the Pacific, the challenge isn't necessarily in creating jobs. The challenge is in growing the economy. The challenge isn't bringing back the manufacturing jobs so much as it is the challenge to create policy that allows the economy to produce innovation and value-added services and products and jobs to produce those services and products. But they're not going to be the same kinds of jobs that we saw in this country in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and early 80s. Trump is going to have to address regulatory hurdles to business growth, barriers to lending, monetary policy missteps at the Federal Reserve, and also, with whatever influence the United States has on foreign central banks, trade imbalances, if they exist, and that's debatable, and where they exist, and that's debatable. Now, some solutions in these areas have been proposed by various Republican legislators and by candidate Trump in one way or another. But the centerpiece of the Trump plan has been to tear up NAFTA, which probably won't happen, to refuse to certify the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which is possible, lowering middle-class taxes when middle-class taxes are already historically low, cutting the corporate tax rate by more than half, and to force spending in one way or another of up to $1 trillion on what he refers to as, quote, infrastructure. This is very controversial with some conservative economists and legislators. Fiddling with trade agreements could put pressure on U.S. headquartered companies to produce in the U.S. as a hedge politically, but they're going to have negative effects with foreign policy, especially with China and our traditional allies in South Korea. Japan, of course, is now the largest foreign investor in U.S. bonds, as well as European allies like Germany and France and the UK. Cutting the corporate tax rate will probably have some effect. I think it's a good thing. But remember, most companies do not pay the full 35% tax rate, including Trump's own companies. Lowering taxes on the most wealthy will produce more investment. And I think that's good, too. But it will cost the new president and the Republican Party politically. So for the most part, this is the government doing what? This is the government raising and lowering the bar. Depending on what side of the bar you're on, this could be a good thing or a bad thing. But it assumes government controls a force of nature that we call the economy. And I don't think this is something that people really fully understand. All of the things that they want to do will have long-term consequences, as I discussed in the previous podcast, but they don't really change the nature of the problem. And the nature of the problem is really the fourth industrial revolution or technology. It's money moving with the touch of a button to anywhere in the world. It's individuals and companies, that really ought to be able to get whatever they want produced wherever they want it produced, because capitalism wants to cut costs and produce at the lowest possible level and sell at a price point that's profitable. Spending $1 trillion on airports and roads or demanding that companies bring back jobs, what does it do? Well, let's take it at its face value that it produces an effect on about 8%, and that's being kind of the eligible workforce. Most people are not employed in as journeyman plumbers or contractors or carpenters or HVAC specialists or electricians or concrete workers. Most of us are employed in small business and services. We don't work at the plant. And spending produces its own problems regarding the burgeoning and dangerous national debt and spending deficits. The most significant economic hurdle we face is the demand of a new age of development. And I'm going to talk about that as well in the final segment here. Are there problems government can solve? Well, yeah, by reversing its involvement in the economy overall, I think, by reducing regulation on corporations, especially in the human services arena, and if this is something that's done, it will get results, by repealing and replacing all entitlements with private sector services, clearing the way for energy exploration and development, and not subsidizing low-output, dead-end alternative energy products, or companies like those owned by Warren Buffett, the railroads, and the energy companies that are subsidized, Bill Gates and Elon Musk. But look who is now advising the new president-elect, right? Elon Musk and some of these very people. So whether or not the government can produce a result with government spending is debatable. But a change of tone, does that produce a result in the economy? Maybe. Can it be long-lasting? I don't think so. I see Trump as a change agent in style and in politics, but I don't see the problems in the so-called Rust Belt and the overall economy as being solved in the manner he has proposed, or in the manner that he's proposed, or the Republican congressional leadership has proposed. I still think we're in a transition period in industry and politics and government and society that is deeply significant, and I remain skeptical that either of the two main political parties in this country have what it takes to make the changes that need to be made. Right? So coming up, well then, Bob Davis, what is the answer? Next. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show.
Just to be stronger than me. You've been here 7 years longer than me. Don't you know you're supposed to be the man? Now pale in comparison to who you think.
Hey, just ahead of segment four of this week's Bob Davis podcast, I'm starting to wake up, with my giant cup of coffee. Love those old prop planes flying over the house. That's really cool, too. That plane, you know what's interesting about that plane? That plane carries, I think they do some kind of delivery out. They fly out every morning to Fargo, and they fly back in the afternoon or early midday, which, of course, I never wake up that early in the morning. But I can always hear them when I'm going to bed flying out, because they fly out about 5 or 6 in the morning. And I don't know what that thing is. It's like a DC-3 or something. And I love that prop sound. And pilots, if you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. And the bottom line with Alpha Systems is that Alpha AOA saves lives, because it is nothing more than a visual indicator of the amount of lift your wing is producing. And that's how you stay safe on that final turn to land. If you want more info on Alpha Systems AOA, click on the Alpha Systems banners for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. Of course, when I think 2017, you know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about 2017 EAA Air Venture at Oshkosh. I'm sure Alpha will be there. And very quickly, we're not done yet, but I want to thank everybody for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast this year on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, and of course, I really appreciate the likes and shares on social media. My favorite is Instagram. I'm still struggling with Facebook and Twitter. I use them, but they drive me crazy. I think they drive everybody crazy, but I do appreciate the subscriptions right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com and on iTunes and comments and everything else. And we will talk a little bit more about some stuff planned for 2017 after we listen to segment 4 of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Here we go.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Remember to subscribe and download all the Bob Davis podcasts. You go to thebobdavispodcast.com. Well, this will be somewhat complex, but the theme that I return to again and again in the podcast and on this show, and I think it's the most significant thing in our society, are these tectonic changes that are taking place throughout the world because of technology. In the Second Industrial Revolution, which would have been the final third of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century, so the 1800s after the Civil War and the early 1900s, well, you could see the revolution. We went from being a largely agrarian nation to a nation with electricity, with skyscrapers and railroads and automobiles on new asphalt and concrete roads. There were consumer products like washing machines, which were a wonder for the average household, and gas stoves. And as I said, electricity, the telephone. We had new electronic media like radio and television. Then we went into the Third Industrial Revolution, so the 1930s through pretty much the 1980s. This is a time most people alive today remember and live through at various, you know, times. And you could also see the changes happening during this period of time. But the new Industrial Revolution, what they call the Fourth Industrial Revolution, produces results that are hard to see because they're microscopic. A cell phone eventually becomes a smart device, and that device becomes more powerful with each iteration. A desktop computer becomes a portable or a pad and is more powerful than anything that preceded it. You have more and more technology, for example, built into your car, but the car looks pretty much the same as a car did 30 years ago, but is materially different on many, many levels. And there have been changes in how we do things, whether it's business software, IT in the workplace, and in the places we go to buy what we need and how we buy what we need every single day, whether it's leisure or the components we need in life, consumer goods, tools, food, and so forth. Generally, these are subtle changes on the surface, but they have potential exponential effects. People laughed at social media, for example, but social media has been responsible for launching revolutions across the world, and for the first time in the United States in the last two presidential cycles, has had a huge impact on our electoral process. We're starting to see electronic checkouts pop up almost everywhere in the retail world, ordering kiosks and things like that. People are beginning to use instant delivery services for things that they would have to run to the store for just a few years ago. You can make your own list of changes because there's tons of them. Some of them are significant. Some are debatably insignificant and will pass away with time. The point here is that small things are producing earth-shattering results. Whether it's fracking and the pipeline protest, to allegations of a Russian hack of Hillary Clinton's server, to time and labor-saving tools that end up amplifying the individual and reducing business costs. You know, we went from listening to the radio to downloading podcasts or building our own Spotify files so we can listen to the music we like whenever we want. We went from two or three TV stations and an afternoon newspaper, let's say, to an infinite supply of information, good and bad, on a device that we carry with us 24 hours a day that collects data on what we watch and when we watch it and what we want and how we want it and what we buy all the time. This has been happening for a while. It's just now beginning to gather speed to the point where we're starting to notice it. And we are seeing unprecedented power and scope. You know, to a large extent, these developments are the economy. And we don't fully understand it. We don't fully grasp its implications. And you see it in the politics. Because what are we talking about? We're talking about reopening steel plants in Gary, Indiana. We're talking about restoring America to that moment in history when you or I thought it was quote-unquote great. What year was that? Was that 1949, 1957? Was it 1962? Was it a sunny day in 1982? Was it back in 1910? Or was it just, you know, last year? It's hard to say. You know, I don't believe that. I think we have to go forward, but we're living in this world of nostalgia and ignoring what is happening right beneath our feet. We have a government and a society constructed to take advantage of something called an industrial revolution that relied on centralization in order to work. Things like central switching, central transmission, downtown big cities, big airports in big cities, central publishing. There's a whole list of things that have become or were central or made centralized after the Depression. Because that was what it took to mass produce and mass distribute products and services, because that's the way things were done. Big office buildings full of people, big plants employing hundreds of thousands of people near big cities. And now we are living in a new era. This dawning era is an era based on mass specialization. That is, goods produced in a decentralized manner all over the world, designed to be specific to an individual. For example, you like a certain kind of basil, heirloom tomatoes, and a really great premium beer. I like a certain kind of steak and some great coffee. 10 years ago, we would have to go to a catalog or find a boutique store someplace or wait weeks for delivery. Now we go online on our phone and we find the best price or the closest place to get it. We order from an app. And the next day, or really within hours, we get our beer and our basil and our tomatoes and our steak and our coffee for the party this weekend. We don't have to wait. You go to the grocery store, and rather than wait in line, we can check ourselves out. And soon, you know, we can fill our cart and walk out of the store, and we don't even have to worry about a checkout if we don't want to. We want to pay cash. There certainly will still be some cashier somewhere. We don't actually even care anymore where our clothing is made, where the car we drive is made, and we won't even need a car for day-to-day use within 20 years because we'll just order one up and it will drive itself over. And by the way, so will the bus. Many people do not understand these changes. Many people do not understand that we don't have to work in office buildings. We don't understand that the creative and inventive are designing and manufacturing and marketing their own products from their homes or from a small satellite office or performing the same tasks they used to perform in a huge office building downtown while at home where they can homeschool their kids or do something else rather than send them to some centralized industrial school where they learn, you know, to fill a role in an industrial society. Now, I don't want to belabor the point because I could go on and it gets boring, but with all this new world that is being created, guess what? We still have a government based on 1950s technology and philosophy. And it's important that people understand. I'm not talking about the Constitution that's old. This idea of guaranteeing human rights and freedom really never gets old. But the government that we have and its mechanisms literally are based on very old centralized technology and they will be disrupted and swept away eventually by the new technologies. And what we're doing is fighting to restore things we really don't need anymore. Promulgating economic policy that seeks to shore up the trappings of a bygone era, having a government that tries to centralize things like retirement programs and health insurance, telling people where and what kind of things they can do in their towns and villages, what kind of development they're going to have, building trains and stadium so carpenters and bus drivers have a job. These are things that not only are a colossal waste of time and resources, but they create tremendous incentives for opportunistic corruption, legal and illegal, and malinvestment of resources that we have granted the government by our consent, in other words, taxation, because we want to help people, or because we think this needs to get done, or because we've concluded such and such was necessary. This is the source of most of the unrest and dissatisfaction in this country, even though we're the most advanced nation in the world. The truth is, we're not going to be the most advanced nation in the world if we do not change these systems soon and permanently, so that new systems can be developed by the people, by individuals and individual corporations, states, towns, cities, counties, whatever. Because we have a government from the 1940s and a world that is rapidly progressing towards something completely different. Again, it isn't our Constitution and its guarantees of basic rights as citizens, its checks and balances. It's the style of government built in the 1930s to address the problems of the Industrial Revolution, eventually perfected to win World War II. The style of government, what it actually does versus what is actually needed, is completely out of sync with the coming reality, even the current reality. Unless we change this and create a new style of government that isn't oppressive and centralized, that is as minimalist as possible, leaving us free to produce and be free, well, then we're just going to continue to revisit the same problems we have now. Now, is Donald Trump and his team going to get that done? We'll find out. That's going to do it for this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. For all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. Well, to say the least, 2017 is going to be a very interesting year, especially after the inauguration. You know, we'll see if there's any kind of crisis, because I'm still standing by to go to Washington if it turns out that there's going to be a big crisis in the Capitol. I doubt it, you know, with the Electoral College finishing the vote. That kind of put the kibosh on a lot of that screaming and yelling and pounding, although that's not going to go away once the Trump administration gets settled. And I'll be talking about that going forward. But, thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Yes, there are going to be changes probably related to the radio show and related to, what I'm doing. Not real significant, but I'm just letting everybody know that, I'm reformulating some of the stuff that I'm doing. And thinking about how I do the radio show and what I do for the radio show and whether I should continue to do the radio show. So we will talk about that going forward in 2017. And once again, thanks for listening to all the Bob Davis podcasts, wherever you listen to them, Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, right off the page, as well as using the streaming audio at thebobdavispodcasts.com. The streaming audio clicks in. If you're on a desktop, it just starts rolling so you can listen to the latest podcasts and it rotates the last three. Eventually, I can create playlists with it. If you want to listen to a podcast off the page, you have to disable the streaming, and there's a stop button in the window. Also, on smartphones, some smartphones it automatically initiates, and some smartphones you have to start playing, but it's a great way to listen to the podcast without having to scroll through all the pages. Now, I want you to scroll through the pages, and if you find a podcast like the Pipeline Podcast, for example, you just scroll through, or you can use a search window that will help you find it, and then you can listen to it on the page if you want, or download it. So those are just some different options. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show and the BobDavisPodcasts.com. Thanks again to XGovernmentCars.com, now doing the SUV sale, which is on through the end of the year. So it's $500 off on any SUV. They have the Ford Police sedans, they have the Ford Police SUVs, Expeditions, and Yukons. And some of those Expeditions are super clean and they have good mileage. So if you need a new car, check out XGovernmentCars.com. Once again, 763-777-8782. God, I got to wake up. And also online at
XGovernmentCars.com.
And don't forget Brush Studio if you're planning a corporate event. It's really a cool place, and it's really a fun thing to do, especially with today's diverse workforce. Reach out to Brush Studio at 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700. They are event planning ninjas. Brush Studio, or look them up at online at brushstudio.net, or you just click on that banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page. Boop.